Okay, welcome to Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, live at Katerina's here in downtown Chicago, 1920 West Irving Park Road. We are here every Tuesday night for recording live, and then, of course, you're listening Tuesday nights from 6 to 8. I should put that whole plug in there. You can come on out to Katerina's and watch the show and watch the interviews and see some live music. And then, of course, you're listening to it on WDCB 90.9 FM on Wednesday nights from 9 until 10 p.m. And then it's also, the extended version is also available on podcast on chicagojazz.com. The show runs usually about an hour, hour and 45 minutes, so we kind of condense it down to the greatest hits for WDCB. And then you can hear the full show with the full interviews and extended play tunes on chicagojazz.com on the podcast. Tonight, I'm excited because we have a very extraordinary vocalist here in Chicago, Paul Marinaro. I've known him for quite a while. I'm sure a lot of people throughout Chicago know the name Paul Marinaro. He is slowly gaining more and more traction nationally. He's got his new CD, Paul Marinaro Without a Song. And why don't we take a listen before we start talking to Paul? Why don't we take a listen to the first two cuts, and then we'll find out a little bit more because we're going to want to get a little explanation on the first cut here. This is intro 1947 into That Old Black Magic from Paul's latest release, Without a Song, here on Chicago Jazz Revealed 90.9 FM, WDCB, and chicagojazz.com. Okay, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers, live from Katerina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road. It's okay for our extensive audience to clap every once in a while. Yes, that's okay. We like to get things loud and wild down here at Katerina's because it's jazz after all, right, Paul?
Absolutely.
It's the only way Paul, I told Paul, he said, I don't know if I'm going to be able to come out tonight because I really like wild audiences
and
screaming and yelling, and we've got it right here. Just look at that crowd.
It's a little early. We'll get them going. The sun is still shining.
As they say, right, that the more they drink, the better we sound.
Exactly.
And it only goes even more towards this interview, I'm sure, with me doing it. But I digressed. So we just heard two tracks off of your new release. Of course, we're here with Paul Marinaro, vocalist Paul Marinaro. We just heard two tracks off of his new release, Without a Song. And track one is Intro 1947, and then it goes right into That Old Black Magic. Now, Intro 1947, that was a little interesting. Now, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that basically sums up the whole concept. Intro 1947 was very hard-gained clips of my dad from 1947. I mean, for those who haven't read the liner notes, or,
let's assume that
most people have
so
read the liner
notes.
Absolutely, it's you know, the story of my dad. He had always wanted to be a singer, and it's kind of where I picked this up. That's kind of why I fell in love with this genre. That's why I fell in love with this music. So I tracked down when I was five. I stumbled upon these old acetates, as they were called, 78 RPM, and I was fascinated by them. That he had the ability to record himself onto a record. I had no idea, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I had no idea that that was possible as a kid. So I was always fascinated with them just as a technology. And then, you know, the music grew on me as well. So when I had this idea to do a few songs, it originally started out as I wanted to have a gift for my dad for his birthday. And I said, I'm going to do a few songs, his favorite songs, songs, you know, that he had taught me or that meant something throughout the years. And I thought about those old acetates, and I just wanted to use them somehow.
Yeah.
I wanted them to be part of the album. I wanted them to be, well, I didn't know it was going to be an album. I thought it was going to be just a personal gift for my dad, but I thought it would be interesting for him to hear this stuff again because he had forgotten about them, and he didn't know that I had them.
Oh, okay.
So they were stored somewhere in his memory, and, you know, they're almost 70 years old,
yeah,
you know, over 60 years old now. So painstakingly, I got these old acetates. Now, when these homemade acetates were meant to last maybe 5 years, They're aluminum core with lacquer coating that you cut into the lacquer.
Oh, okay.
So they were not meant for...
Right. They're just for fun at
for
home.
For fun
probably,
and,
right?
You know, yeah. People on the street, wow, you can record yourself. And everyone would gather around right. And cut their 3.5 minutes into a disc. So the fact that they're here in 2013 is astonishing in and of itself. The fact that they were thrown in the garbage when I was 5 years old, I had taken them literally out of the garbage. My brothers had thrown them out for some reason, and I was horrified. And I saw these you know, priceless things being tossed out, and I grabbed, there were stacks of them. I grabbed as many as I could and put them under my bed.
And you're five.
I was 5 years old. I have no idea. It seemed perfectly logical to me now. And the more I've talked about this project to people, I realize that that was probably, you know,
right.
Not
it's
what
incredible.
Most 5-year-olds were doing right. Or would have cared to do. So I took them out of the garbage and saved them all these years. And then they were lost for another 20 years. So the fact that we were able to get any sound information off mm-hmm. of them is kind of, I just took it as a sign. I chose to take it as a sign that it was meant to be.
Where do you even take the acetates? I mean, who, where do you even do that? I mean,
well,
I can't imagine
between,
you call somebody up.
In between gigs and in between looking for work to wind down at night, it was a project that I did on my own for a long time because I always have wanted to, save the information off of these discs. So I have a bunch of different old turntables, old, you know, audio equipment. I know just enough to be dangerous with, but I'm fascinated by the technology of it all. So I had already been fooling around with these stuff and different freeware on the computer, different programs.
Right,
so I was dumping the information into the computer, you know, at different speeds. Destroying needles as I go along because there's literally gaps of information that it's gone.
Right.
So I'm trying to.
So you can actually play it on a regular record player, and then
Would play on a regular. As long as it was, you know, to play it properly, it had to be 78 RPM.
Right.
But I discovered very quickly that they were too warped and too flaked to play it at that high speed. So I thought about what about 33 1/3, and then digitally, you know. So I tried everything, and some grooves literally were groove by groove. Some were 16 RPM, and then I figured out, you know, digitally how to speed them up to the proper speed.
What was it like the first time you actually put something on there and you could hear your dad's voice?
It was, well, the first one I heard was not him singing. The first disc was conversations of, he had recorded his parents. He had recorded his grandparents.
Wow.
And I'm from a very old family. My dad's 85, and my grandparents, I'd never met his parents, and my great-grandparents. So you're talking about people 150 years. So it was fascinating. That just kind of gave me chills, especially when I got it to the right speed.
That'd be amazing.
And it was interesting because my dad wasn't talking. Now, the one person on this album that I would be able to say that that's, you know, that's his voice. He wasn't talking, so all these other people were foreign voices to me. And, of course, they're speaking in Italian, which I only know some varied curse words. That's about it.
Let's just get it right out.
That's it. Yeah, so. But they were so scratched, and you try to fix the skips, and you try to fix what's on each side of a skip, and you try to make it, you know, with a song that's easy to do because you're going to hear the melody. With people speaking in a language that you don't know, it's much more difficult to kind of digitally fix the skips and what's on each side of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some you don't know if it's skipped three grooves, and you need to go back.
Right.
And
right.
So
man,
one
talk
of the,
about painstaking work, though.
It it was so much fun, and I would do this at night, and I would do it on my own, and just, you know, go look at the waveforms, and figure out what the scratches were, and kind of zoom in and take them out the best you can.
Jeez,
there are probably audio engineers listening in, like he doesn't have a clue what he's talking about. But
we could have fixed that in 5 minutes. What's this guy doing?
So one of the more damaged parts of this ancient Italian conversation from 1946, it was really badly damaged, and I had no kind of guide point. And then I heard in the background, my dad was whistling. You are the promised kiss of springtime. And I hear the melody way in the background.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's what I'm going to... I knew how to match it because he was singing
yeah.
All the things you
yeah.
are way in the background. So that was one of the first ones that I kind of restored and then cleaned up as much, you know, ran it in through different filters and mm-hmm. cleaned out. But when I knew, when I got to my dad's singing, I always knew that I wanted to kind of preserve that stuff. Because it really was, as a kid... Looking back, when I first heard that stuff, we played them as a kid, and then they were lost again for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I remembered them, and I remembered distinctly that old Black Magic, because I thought it was, spooky and Black Magic and
right,
stuff.
Yeah.
So I connected it that as a kid to that. But it was my first hearing of that genre and having my dad be the vessel
mm-hmm.
from this old acetate. It always fascinated me. And I think it was really interesting because I never thought that the song was old. I never put a date to it and thought, that's a great old song. I just thought it was a cool song.
Right.
Which is kind of where I'm at today,
mm-hmm.
35 years later. I still look at this material and people will ask, why do you sing these old songs? And I never think of them as old songs. I don't date music that way. So it probably started... very early on. So that was definitely a choice that when I wanted to do this tribute to my dad and kind of let him revisit his musical path, that was the first one I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that old Black Magic, and I had, we had come up with an arrangement, a new arrangement of it, so I thought, I wonder if I could somehow blend the two or start with it. Friends, many wise voices tried to talk me out of that when I decided to release the album.
What was their reasoning? I mean,
a lot of people
now
just,
I'm listening to the finished product, so I,
right.
It's one thing.
And I questioned it myself. A lot of people thought, for your dad, for his birthday present, give him the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
but for your album, take that stuff off.
Right.
I think people felt that without the story, people would just be hearing some scratchy old noise and not identify with it. I think some of them felt that it was too personal a project, that, my dad's not Nat King Cole, so who cares about Joseph Marinaro that never made it as a singer?
Right, yeah.
And I could see the reasoning in that. I thought about it long and hard, and I think that having it introduce the songs, it gives it a sense of history.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives listeners the ability to experience it exactly as I did, or exactly as they want to, in 2013. We all know that these are old songs, and here it was almost brand new by some...
Sure, yeah.
Some guy that no one knows singing right. it in his house. And I think from a technological aspect, it's very interesting to kind of rescue this old audio.
Mm-hmm.
But also from a very... it's just very powerful. I would hoped, and it seems to be with a lot of people when they listen, it's specific enough. It's obviously a very personal project to me, but I think it's also the scope of it is generic enough that people can kind of get the heart of the story without having to know me or my family.
Right.
So,
well, and when I first got the CD and I popped it in, obviously I didn't know the whole backstory.
Sure.
I knew that it was a tribute to your father, but I didn't know it was a backstory, but I thought it was great. I thought the way the whole thing flowed right in. So I think you're right on track with all of that.
Yeah, and I think some of the other – I did listen to some of the other conversations about, well, what if any of the radio stations that are left want to play that old Black Magic? You're not always going to want to go back and listen to the minute and 25
right.
seconds
sure.
or whatever it is of your dad that is, powerful, but – every time you want to listen to the song. So we have a distinct cut in there where if you want to listen to them all together, it'll play straight through, but it'll also, if you want to start it right at the beginning of the new,
Black
that
Magic.
Old Black Magic,
yeah.
it'll do that. So we did, that was harder to do than I thought it was going to be. Yeah, I'm thinking, well, yeah, I told Scott Steinman at studio meeting, yeah, sure, let's just put a start right there. It is, different, you know, a Blu-ray player will start that much different than a DVD player, the CD player.
Oh, you know.
So there's a lot of different factors. So
he's like, yeah, sure. It's real easy, Paul.
No problem.
Well,
we just rescued, you know, audio from ancient acetates. How hard could this be?
Well, let's hear another track off of this. Now, this is Everything Must Change. And, of course, this is with the great vocalist, Judy Roberts.
Sure.
And somebody that you play a lot with when she comes back to town.
Mm-hmm.
I know you guys are doing a Monday here before she goes back to Arizona. A Tuesday before
Tuesday.
She goes back to Arizona. This will air after that, so
sure.
It does us no good.
It's going to be a wonderful show.
It was an incredible show, Paul.
Night.
It's unbelievable. But you also do things with her at 3160 where you're also there on Wednesdays when she's not in town. You're there at 3160 Bar.
Yeah, 7 years.
7 years.
7 years.
On Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock.
Uh-huh.
So you've got Judy on here. Who else is on here? Is it just you and Judy on this track?
On this track, it's the only one that Judy appears on. So it's just Judy on piano and me. This was Judy happened to be in town just briefly for, I think it was, she had to come into town for someone's funeral.
Oh, okay.
So she was just, I think it was Nick Tuntis.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And so she wasn't supposed to be in town, and that happened to be when I was still recording some of this. So she came into town unexpectedly for that, and I told her what I was doing with the project, and she was really interested in it. She did, obviously, an album with her dad, and, mm-hmm. You know, years ago. And she said, if I'm still awake after all of this and have enough wherewithal emotionally, meet me at Studio Media, and I have a song. And so she sent me the song during the day, and I didn't know it. I had never heard Everything
really?
Must Change.
Yeah.
And she said, well, you know, sure, there's a lot of versions. And I had never listened to it, so I sat with it and thought, it's a perfect song. And I thought it was something that's something my father would identify with it, and I thought it would be beautiful with Judy. So 3 o'clock in the morning, we went in, and this is the take.
All right, well, let's take a listen. Everything Must Change here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM, WDCB.
Makes me cry.
All right, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. It's okay to clap. It's okay to clap. Thank you. That was Paul Marinaro from his latest release, Without a Song. And that was Everything Must Change. That was a beautiful song.
Thank you.
And I think you mentioned before we went to it that Judy brought it in. You had never heard it before. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, you guys recorded it that day.
I think I had flipped by it in a fake book back and forth and never really paid much attention to it. I was aware of it, but I didn't have any versions floating around in my head or didn't know it. So,
well, you know, why don't we talk a little bit about your background?
Sure.
Because we talked a lot about the new release.
Mm-hmm.
And now we should probably – I know probably every listener listening to this right now knows exactly who you are and knows your background. But for my sake –
You got it.
Let's find out where you came from here. So, obviously, we know that you were a fan of music. Your dad was a fan of music coming up. Did you go to college for music, or did you just kind of take over?
I did. You know, with my dad having wanting to be a singer, it was always kind of something that was around in the house, and we would sing along, and, you know, I had piano lessons, you know, starting about 5 or 6 years old, and, you know, we would gather around the piano, so it was a big musical Italian family.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, from the piano lessons in high school, I had a teacher kind of pull me aside and wanted me to do the musicals. So I bet you can sing. And up until that point, I, you know, my father sang, my sister sang, my brother sang, and I was just the pianist.
Oh, really? You didn't even try
sang before high school, and And even then it was, you know, kicking and screaming. But it's odd because when no one was around, I would sing all the time. Which is why on the album, getting back to that briefly, I chose to do a couple of the Sinatra songs because I would borrow my father's cassettes, and they were Sinatra, and he would play them in his car, and I would sing along to all of them, like "World on a String" and "I Get a Kick Out of You."
Sure.
I did not want to include them initially because I've kind of steered clear of being another Sinatra singer. Right. There's plenty of them. But I thought with revisiting this theme of looking back on how I got into all of this, I thought it was important to kind of say that it was definitely there, you know.
Well, you know, but talking about like the Sinatra stuff, obviously you're influenced by him.
Sure.
And, you know, there's obviously the Sinatra impersonators. And then there's the really established vocalists playing those tunes because they're great in the style that you play them. You know, take them on
yourself.
Right,
once I was, exactly, maybe, you know, 5-10 years ago, I would never have attempted it. Now I feel confident enough in what I do that it doesn't draw a comparison.
Right.
I don't, you know, try to imitate what he did. So anyway, that's kind of how it all started. In high school, I started doing, you know, musicals and things like that. And realized quickly that while I loved that, I loved the music part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothered me, you know, in like, you know, The King and I or in one of these shows that I couldn't do what I wanted with the songs. I had to sing them in
right.
the keys that they were written and at the tempo that someone else told me to.
And you had to act while
and
you
I had
were
to
singing
act,
them.
And,
yeah.
you know, once the dancing thing came, I'm like, okay, this isn't going to work. This is not
going to
work.
Were you Yul Brynner's character? I just have to know. In King and I, did you have a bald thing on your head?
I shaved it off.
Oh, yeah.
I shaved
you were the
it
king,
off.
Huh?
I was the king.
I think we're going to put you on the cover of Chicago Jazz Magazine
I'll
as,
dig
the
out
king.
One of those.
As the king.
Which, you know, it's interesting because I revisited all of those great memories in doing this album because my father saw me in The King and I. It was the first, I think, the first musical that he came in. It was my senior one, and I was the king, and he thought I was going to go be an actor. He's like, oh, no, he's got the bug too, you know,
right,
meaning
yeah.
the showbiz because he knew he had it all his life and walked away from it. So he thought, this kid's going
to...
You know,
right. Go to New York. He's
exactly.
going to Broadway.
And I,
yeah.
you know, I did a bit of that until I got tired of starving. then I became a jazz musician.
Yeah,
I'm not
right.
quite sure where the logic the logic came in there. But anyway, that was my father said there was a great show, but you didn't get to sing any of the good songs. You know, the king doesn't really
right,
sing.
Yeah.
So I included "I Have Dreamed" on the album, revisiting kind of.
You know,
that
it's
memory.
Interesting though that you said that too, because you're talking about being able to do them yourself and do it that way. You know, when you really start to think about all of those musicals, there's such great tunes in those musicals that now I'm sure you play them on a nightly basis.
Sure. Sure.
Everywhere, you know, and I don't know how many people out, you know, obviously the jazz musicians and jazz fans know them a certain way, but I think that the general population don't really realize how many great standards came out of those musicals.
Came out of those shows, exactly.
Right.
Even, you know, a lot of the Rodgers and Hart stuff, the shows weren't, we don't remember the shows anymore because they weren't the gigantic hits that the Rodgers and Hammerstein stuff was. But the tunes have, you know, lived on 80 years now, some of them. But when I went to college, right out of high school, I went to the University at Buffalo for music, for voice and piano. And I shouldn't have been there. I wasn't ready. It was the absolute wrong school for me. If it wasn't Mozart, it didn't matter.
Oh, yeah.
And I knew I was never going to be an opera singer. And
Why'd you go there?
It was close to home.
Oh.
I was kind of a late bloomer when it was close to home, and I got in, and, you know, it was a mistake looking back, but oh well. So I didn't get a chance to really develop as a musician for a while, and I quit and got a regular job and started making good money.
What's a regular job?
I got a regular job at a finance company.
Oh, that's a pretty regular job. Yeah,
I was working my way up in, I started out as collections and, you know, in the mailroom, and I kind of worked my way up. And right as they were going to promote me and they were going to send me for schooling to be kind of a bigger manager in the back, and it was decent money for a 20-something-year-old kid.
Sure.
I got petrified. And it was that moment where I just thought, if I do this, I may never go back. And I thought of my dad, and I thought of the bitterness that he still held. He's you know, very happily married, and he has a wonderful family at 85 years old surrounding him, but it's still there.
Yeah, yeah.
If you handed him a microphone and he could sing, he would try it.
Yeah.
And I thought of that, and I got petrified that if I went on this path any further, that I may never go back to school, I may never finish a degree. And I turned it down. And then I went to another school that didn't have a jazz program. It's a little farther away from home, but I had
a hot streak. Huh?
I had a much better. But it was so I went back to college a little later in my 20s and had a great experience. I learned a lot. I'm not sure I learned anything in any of the classes per se, but the music department was a wonderful department, and that's when I really started. Pursuing the jazz thing in Buffalo. I was still in mm-hmm. Buffalo, New York, or close enough. And I would go to this one club, the Anchor Bar in Buffalo, New York. And it's the place that invented the chicken wing.
Oh, literally, I've heard of that place. Yeah, exactly. They've been on the news, sure.
They invented the chicken wing, and they've had jazz bands there for probably almost 90 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go every weekend, and I would see this old, she was the first female vocalist ever signed to Blue Note. Her name was Dodo Green, and it's with Ike Quebec is on it. The only reason it's been reissued is because Ike Quebec happens to be on. I forget who else is on the album. But it was her one big chance, and it didn't go anywhere, you know, and then she toured the Catskills. But I would go see her. She retired to Buffalo, and she was probably in her 80s now. And she would do this jazz cabaret act in the middle of the bar, and it was a riot. So each week I would say, "Well, you guys, let me try something." You know, I was practicing at home,
right, sure.
and never worked with a jazz band in my life, and they would consistently turn me down every week. And one week they had a guest pianist by the name of Al Tinney, and on break he said, "Come over here, kid." He said, "I'll let you sing after the break." And he's like, "Well, you know, just think of your tune and your key." Of course, I never thought about that.
Right, that was the one thing you didn't think about.
Never thought about
it.
Right? I never thought they would let me. So I guessed at, I think, C for "Don't Get Around Much Anymore," typical standard. And it worked out okay. But Al Tinney happened to be another retiree to Buffalo that had kind of an unknown and unsung storied career. He was kind of one of the founders of bebop. He was with Parker and yeah. X Roach and all those guys, and he left New York City. There's a lot of articles written about him now, but mm-hmm. We were just finding this all out. He left because he didn't like the drug scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But he used to tell me stories about working with all these guys and working with Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
And so he would kind of bring me around to different clubs, and there were some jam sessions, and I was thinking back on what an amazing opportunity it was, because I really had no idea what I was doing.
To be taken under the wing by somebody like that.
It was amazing. It really was. So,
so that's really where you started getting your chops together.
Yeah.
And how'd you end up in Chicago?
I did one big night in Buffalo at a club, the Calumet Arts Cafe, and all those guys decided to come over and back me. And I said, "Listen, I have no idea, you know, I think we were working the door or something like
right.
that." They're like, "Don't worry about it, kid. We'll do it." So, of course, my whole extended, large, gigantic Italian family showed up, so I didn't have to worry about anybody else. And shortly after that, I was visiting a friend in Iowa, and I was driving back, and I had never been to Chicago, so I stopped off.
What year was this?
This was 2000.
Oh, okay.
So, wow, 13 years ago.
Yeah.
I stopped off, and I visited Chicago, and I saw the scene, and then 2003 I moved here.
Wow.
So I kind of got a taste of it, and I saw that, you know, people actually did this for a living. Like, you could do this. Little did I know. No, I can't complain. I've been here 10 years, and I was having a conversation with the wonderful Andy Brown, great guitarist, mm-hmm. recently, and we were talking about different perceptions that maybe our friends or, you know, the people that have real jobs have of us or have of this mentality. And it's amazing because you're constantly asked, like people say, how is your CD doing? It's wonderful. I'd never, you know, this was a project that I thought that I was just going to give as a gift to my dad. It's selling copies. It's success.
Yeah,
period.
Exactly. Sure.
And Andy and I both, I think he had this conversation with different family members. We're working. It's 2013. We're not sacrificing the music that we love, and we work. And I really, it's been difficult, but for 10 years, there hasn't been a week that's gone by that I haven't had a gig, that I had to look for work. I know how fortunate I am, and yeah. I don't ever take that for granted. But Chicago's been very, very good to me.
Well, now we should talk a little bit about what you've been doing. Obviously, you play every Wednesday night at 3160 Bar. Mm-hmm. Which is 3160 North Clark.
Exactly.
That's why I remember where it is, because it's the address.
Right.
So I'm like, there it is. You've been there for how long now?
I started there by accident, or just not expecting much. It wasn't a music club, but the owner, Jim Flint, he said, you know, I want to have a little...
He's a fan of music, though.
He's a fan of music. He had known Judy years ago when she was dating one of the Cubs, I think.
Right.
Back in the...
We'll have to have her come on and talk
about
that.
I'm not going to get into telling Judy stories. But so he wanted to try a jazz night, and I started it with Judy and some other players. And I thought once Judy moved away that he would kind of say, well, it's been a nice run. But he let me bring in my own guys. And I can't believe when I look at the date that it's been 7 years.
It's amazing. Every Wednesday night.
Every Wednesday night.
9 o'clock?
9 o'clock.
9 to midnight, 9 to 1. 9 to 1-ish.
9 to 12:30. If we have a loving audience, we'll go a little late.
Well, a lot of musicians in town stop over there and hang out. It's kind of a nice hang.
It's a really, you know, it's an intimate place, and, you know, you kind of go up a couple steps and you can sit up near the piano, and we've had some wonderful players throughout the years come in and sit in, or I'll put them on the gig.
Yeah. Now, you also have been doing some things at the Green Mill. And you had this big weekend Friday night or Saturday night at the Green Mill, which really
Friday
kind of...
Friday night, yeah.
That was the first time you've been there, right? I mean, this was, what, 3-4 months ago now?
When I first got to Chicago, I didn't jump into the jazz scene as quickly as I would have liked to. And I kind of didn't know if I was going to stay here or not. The first few years, I wasn't quite sure. And I would go to the Green Mill, and it was kind of like this wonderful respite. And I would sit at the bar, and I would watch the performers, and I just fell in love with the place. I romanticize things of the past. I obviously like antiques and things of the past. So just being in that room, I can you know, imagine the ghosts of who might have been there. I have wonderful stories about where and when Billie Holiday was there. I've been told that none of them are true, or I have them wrong, but I'm sticking to what my fantasy is. So I've always wanted to do the Green Mill, and it was based on the success of our CD release party. We did that at the Showcase, another storied historical room, and that was just unbelievable. My family came in. My dad came in for that, for his big release, and it was wonderful to see him signing.
Yeah.
He was signing CDs, and so that was a lot of fun. But I kind of got the shot to do the Green Mill based on all of this and the wonderful response, and I had no idea what to expect. And I said, you know, Dave, I don't know what we're going to get, because we just did a bunch of shows, and I think I've spent going to on this. And he said, try it out, you know, in his wonderful Chicago accent.
Yeah, he's great.
And it was just a fantastic night.
And now you're doing some cocktail. He actually added in this new cocktail.
Well, I'm subbing for Chris Foreman while he's gone.
Oh, okay, while Chris is out on
tour. So Chris has been doing that. So he said, yeah, you probably don't want to do these early Fridays. And believe it or not, most Fridays I don't. I don't have gigs for some reason. They've been open right now. I don't go after the weekend things. Seem to be a bit more noisy than I like. So I've been off. So this they've been wonderful. I've had some great guitarists with me. So
you have a couple more coming up. So it's September 20th and 27th at the Green Mill, which is from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., which is, for those of you that don't know, the Green Mill is right on the corner of Lawrence and Broadway. And, of course, more information at WDCB.org and ChicagoJazz.com. And, of course,
PaulMarinaro.com.
That's easy. So you have that. But then also you do some things over here at Caterina's, too.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. So that people should always check the schedule. And I don't know if you have a date yet with her coming up yet, but if not, I'm sure
this airs.
Right.
But usually we do something once or twice a month here. I think we're on 14. This will be our 14th or 15th show that we do. We'll do a different tribute to a composer.
Right.
We'll do a whole night, Ellington or Harold Arlen or or Gershwin or something like that. So we've had some great success here. This is also one of my favorite places.
And that's why I'm really glad we're able to do the show, because it's intimate enough. But when you're playing here, it's intimate, but it still feels good in the room, and people can really, you know, see somebody like you up front and personal and up close. Well, why don't we listen to one last track?
Sure.
And we're going to hear the title song here, Without a Song.
Exactly.
And anything we should know about Without a Song before?
Without a Song, I struggled with the title of the CD. You know, for a while, the working title was Songs for My Father, but of course that's been done in a much different way, and I didn't want to do that. And then I thought of my dad all his life. How fortunate I am to be able to do this weekly, this passion, and express this artistry. And I thought of my dad for most of his life. He wasn't able, but it was still in there. So I thought, and this is a song that he had sung throughout his whole life. So the song, we won't do it today, but the song on the album, actually, this is the last track. The first and the last track have those 1947 intros.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, we also rescue the audio. So this one on the album, also has that intro, and we added a little strings behind it as well.
Yeah.
But we'll jump right to the real track for time's sake
tonight. Well, thanks for coming in, Paul.
Thank you, Mike.
It's great
this
to see you as usual. And we'll be right back. So we're going to hear Without a Song from Paul's latest recording, Without a Song, here on WDCB, Chicago Jazz Revealed, and ChicagoJazz.com. Support for WDCB and Chicago Jazz Revealed comes from the University of Chicago Presents, announcing its new series, Jazz at the Logan, at the Rava and David Logan Center for the Arts in Hyde Park. The season opens on October 25th with The Bad Plus and continues with Annette Cohen, Dick Hyman, Bill Charlap, and others. Single ticket and subscription information at chicagopresents.u, chicago.edu. Welcome to Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers here live at Caterina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road. It's okay if the audience wants to clap a little bit. You can clap, you can talk, you can drink and eat and enjoy the interview here. Of course, we're here live every Tuesday night, recording from 6 o'clock until 8 o'clock. So come on down to 1920 West Irving Park Road. And then also, this is airing, and you're listening to this on WDCB on Wednesday nights from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. And the full podcast, because most shows are about an hour and 45 minutes long. And, of course, we have to shrink it down and condense it for WDCB to get in that hour. You can hear the full uncut podcast, uncut, Marlene, so you can go nuts.
Talk fast, okay.
uncut on ChicagoJazz.com. And, of course, I'm sitting here with the great bassist from Chicago, Marlene Rosenberg, who was featured on Chicago Jazz Magazine's cover for the July-August issue. How are you?
I'm fine. A true honor. Thank
you,
Mike.
Thanks for coming down. I'm glad you could do it. And I know you have a ton of dates coming up, and you're also playing the after set down here tonight. And for most people that are listening, if you do come down, there's always live music afterwards, either somebody on the show or somebody else who's performing after the show. We call it the after set. So just a little plug for the live live performances that happen after, because I think it's really important to promote live music. And even though we're up here talking and we're going to hear Marlene perform tonight, you know, there's a lot of live music happening in Chicago and in a lot of different places. And looking at your calendar, you are on most of them. Oh. So, you know, let's just start at the beginning. I mean, you've played with everybody from Joe Henderson, Ed Thigpen, Cedar Walton, the great, you know, the late, great Cedar Walton, and hundreds of other people. But how did you get your start playing bass? How did you decide to just, I mean, you know, bass is kind of a one of those instruments right. that not everybody gravitates to.
Yeah, I don't know why. well, actually, I was a clarinet player in high school. And then my band director needed a bass player, which is often the case. And I thought jazz was cool and hip. And the only way I get to play it is if I played bass.
Yeah.
So I did play saxophone in one of the bands, and then I played bass in the other band.
Oh, no kidding.
And he gave me the electric bass and said, here, strings, E-A-D-G, go learn it. And so I proceeded to write the notes above each note, or the letter names above each note. And the rest is history. And then I went to U of I as a clarinet major and changed my major to bass.
So you actually went to college as a clarinet,
major.
So you were still practicing clarinet throughout high school.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I didn't start until my senior year of high school on bass.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, did you can you still play clarinet?
No. No, not that anybody would want to hear. I do have one in my storage. And,
do you?
Yeah, I think about it. I think about it.
Now, when you were at U of I, is that when, I mean, U of I's music school has been, you know, legendary. Was that when, is it Garvey was down there?
Yeah, John Garvey was down there. Ray Sasaki, Morgan Powell, cast of thousands.
Yeah.
And Jeff Lindbergh, who has his big band up here, actually was in his band, which was the lowest band, the sixth band, a great band, but you know, I was just beginning bass, and so he really helped me. And then I played in Garvey's band, Ray Sasaki's band, as I learned.
And down there, when I mean, you know more about this obviously because you were there, but I mean, I've heard all the stories from you know the Joel Spencer and Kelly Sill and all the guys that were down there as well. That was like almost a professional band down there. I mean, that band was it was. That whole music school at that time was just churning out musician after musician after musician that were coming to Chicago and playing or going to New York and playing.
Absolutely. And really since the 50s and especially in the 60s in the band, Garvey had affiliation with Bali and Russia, and he would take the
really?
Band. They'd go.
And so you got to go?
No, it was before my time.
Oh, okay.
Even though I was there back in the dinosaur age, yeah, it was still before my time. So it was great. It was a great experience, and the thing about it was there was no jazz curriculum. We made our own jazz curriculum.
Oh, really? So it was more like classical-based stuff?
It was just your normal music school.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Which is pretty much classical-based kind of,
classical-based,
you know,
theory and all that, but there were so many people who played jazz that very oral art as it is, you know, it was handed down. And, and I sought it out. So, we played all the time, you know, rehearsals and every weekend jam sessions.
Yeah.
And, you know, listening parties. And it was really quite wonderful.
You know, I'm going to jump around a little bit since we're talking about this. You teach.
I do.
Now, I mean, what colleges are you at?
I'm at, you could never be at too many colleges,
right?
Adjunctly, I'm at Northwestern.
Okay.
And I work with the small jazz ensembles there.
Mm-hmm.
And at Northern Illinois, I just took on teaching. Let's see, intro to jazz course, and I'll be working with the combos as well.
Okay. So, you know, since we're talking about, I mean, everything you did at U of I is pretty much like you didn't have to do it. You right. loved doing it, and it was right. like that self-starter thing, and everybody around there was just doing it because nobody in class made you go do this or do that or do this. Do you see that in the kids now? Are they outside of the class? Do you know, it's not a knock on them, but do you think that it's that culture is so much as passionate as you guys were?
Actually, no. No. I mean, yes and no.
Right.
You know, it has to be sort of taught to them that this is what's necessary. And since it's provided in terms of the curriculum, mm-hmm. I think there's that expectation that they don't need to pursue it any further. But the fact of the matter is they do, because 2 hours a week or even 4 hours a week, two times a week is not enough,
right.
if possible. You know, and I know that they're busy because when you're in music, you're so overloaded by, you know, quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you get? One credit for a rehearsal, you know, and you spend how many hours a week doing that? So
right.
much different than coursework. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, every time I talk to somebody about this, it's one of those things, and I don't think a lot of jazz fans understand how much of learning jazz and learning the music and getting inside of it is just, you know, you either want to do it or you don't want to do it. And like in a college, you have to go to this class, but really, don't you think that outside of that class, when you can really experiment and play around with this stuff and really listen and like just delve into it like 24/7, that's really when you get the most out of your playing?
Yeah. Yeah, you really have to experientially get into the music, like you say. Now, hopefully the class provides that template for you to take the information and go and use it. And when you're playing, you know, with your friends, with your peers, mm-hmm. and when you're out playing a gig, you know, a lot of the people have learned to book their gigs at different coffee shops and tea houses and
yeah.
that kind of thing, which is great because that's what we used to do as well.
Yeah.
And so you can take all that information and, you know, weave it into the actual format of playing music.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
When you were at U of I, and you're doing all this on your own, when did all of a sudden, what was your first gig, whether it was with people from there or maybe somebody from out of town, where you said, you know what, I want to do this, and I think I can do this for a living? Or did it just kind of just organically happen?
Well, the weird and silly thing about me is in high school, I remember a conversation with my English lit teacher, who I loved because I have a passion for writing poetry, or I did back then mm-hmm. anyway. And I told him, I want to be a musician, or maybe I want to be a writer. And he looked at me and said, no, you don't. And I said, yes, I think I do. And he goes, no, that's really not a good idea. And I went, but I do. So all that to say that pretty much I think I had it kind of set in my head that I was either going to do that, be a social worker, or be in music.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got to the U of I, I sort of, ignorance is bliss, and maybe not as positive as my good buddy Paul Marinaro there, but, you know, I love what I do, but, yeah, and I really never thought of doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly enough, I was just in the moment.
Well, and probably when you're surrounded by so many players and so much stuff going on, you don't even think about it. It's like, you know, I can't imagine you're sitting down at night going, you know, now is this the most reasonable decision I could possibly make?
Who thinks reasonable
right.
when you're 17? Sorry, I say that to my daughter.
Right.
But you know, I don't know. Maybe Einstein. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, so when you're at U of I, and then. Did you leave there, come up to Chicago? How did that whole thing happen?
U of I, and actually, I'd like to just add, I actually wrote my own jazz curriculum.
Really?
When I was down there, there was a small little italicized, in very small print at the bottom of the catalog, open options. I went, yes, that's me. I grabbed it and figured out how to do that. And the dean, I bugged him to death. You know, he was smiling. So I actually really rewrote my program. I had to petition out of certain classes. It included ethnomusicology because U of I at the time there had African music taught by people who were specialized in that.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese music, Indian.
Okay.
So I took all of those courses. Not that I remember very much of it, but yes. And that really fed into my, you know, musical career.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I really did write my own program, although I had to take the basic classes theory. I didn't really have to take Western music history, which was like...
I remember taking that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
So lucky me.
That was a lot of fun.
So I really made my own. It was back in the olden days.
So what's your degree in? What is it?
It's in jazz, bass, and composition.
Really?
I have a minor in composition and a major in jazz bass, and it's just a bachelor of music.
Yeah.
From there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you did all of that, and then when you left U of I, did you come up to Chicago, or were you already playing up here? Probably. I mean, a lot of people were driving back and forth.
Right. I was driving back and forth, and then, yeah, I came up here and, you know, decided to come here because so many people I knew, and I knew I could work, and I sort of did it like that.
So what was your first gig? I mean, plus when you were up, there was probably a lot more jazz clubs happening up here at that point. I mean, there was a lot of stuff going on compared. There's a lot of
different stuff
going on now, but it was more, you know, compact, I guess I would say. Is that right? I mean, all the clubs were kind of together.
There was Rush Street.
Right, yeah.
So there was town.
Yeah.
Of music up and down the street, you know, where we would play at different clubs, you know. So that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was still the Jazz Showcase.
Was that on Rush, or was that over at the Blackstone?
That was at the Blackstone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great.
Room, man.
It was great.
I love that room over there.
Someone described it as the inside of a giant birthday cake. When you look at it, you know, the pillars,
mm-hmm.
right? They're like these Romanesque pillars, and it was sort of in these gray and weird kind of blue
hues. Like that blue on the wall.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah, you know, so. But it was, yeah, great music coming through there.
Well, so you're playing around Chicago, and then how did you all of a sudden start playing with all these heavy-duty international guys that everyone would know? Like, I mean, what was your first gig? I mean, I know you were with Ed Thigpen for a long time. You played with Joe Henderson. You played with...
Right. I'm trying to think of what came first. I know that John Whitfield, a bass player mm-hmm. here, had recommended me for the gig with Joe Henderson. He had an all-female group, and at the time, the bassist that was working with him... wasn't going to be working with him for some reason. She needed to leave, or I don't know if she was having a baby or what the situation was. So he recommended me, and then I got the call. And so then I started working with him and touring for about a year and a half. And Renee Rosness was on piano, Sylvia Cuenca on drums, sometimes mm-hmm. Cindy Blackman.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. There were a few other pianists, Lynn Bernstein and Aki Takasa, I think I'm saying her name right, from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And she's still working. I know that. So, of course, Rini is still working.
Yeah.
And so is Sylvia, and Cindy Blackman is off the charts. So.
Right, right. Wow, that's quite the band there.
Yeah.
Now, you've got a CD here of that group. Should we take a listen to it?
I'm not sure we should take a listen to it.
It's kind of a raw recording?
It's a raw recording, and it's definitely... I don't know. I haven't listened to it in a while, and it might be a little scratchy, and God knows what we'll get.
Well, let's not do that, though.
All right.
Let's not do that. When you're playing with Joe Henderson and you're doing all that, obviously now your name's getting around.
Right.
And how did you end up with playing with Ed Thigpen? He was one of my favorite drummers. Obviously, Ed Thigpen's a legendary.
He was
fabulous. The man. Yeah.
Another one that's left us. And actually, Ray Brown, who was a friend of mine, mentor, of course,
mm-hmm, yeah.
And he actually recommended me to Ed. And so this was my first, you know, international recording, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really exciting and frightening. But Ed, yeah, we played a lot.
Now, how many years were you with Ed? Probably here and there, right?
It was sort of here and there.
Yeah.
You know, we did the NAMM show out in California, a few other... one or two of those, International Jazz Educators Association at mm-hmm. the time. Now it's called JEN,
right.
Jazz Educators Network. conference for that, and a few gigs here and there, of course, here at the Jazz Showcase when he would come, and then this recording. And, well, oh, we played, I'm sorry, oh, North Sea Jazz Festival, we did play there.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. Now, Ed Thigpen's famous for playing with Ray Brown, Oscar Peterson. I mean, there's probably a million questions here, but I mean, what is it like for you to all of a sudden be playing with this drummer that, you know, basically he's been playing with Ray Brown forever, and now it's all about you?
Well, it wasn't all about me, but, you know, what am I going to do was more the question. And, you know, Ed guided me in terms of, like, kind of where he wanted me to place the beat, what he was used to feeling from Ray. You know, I would listen, of course.
Sure.
So that I was, you know, hoping I would, not that I would ever sound like Ray, not that I was, you know, not that that would be a bad thing. It would be a very good thing. But, you know, just trying to figure out how I should play the music the best way possible, you know, in the context of his group.
Yeah. I mean, it's talk a little bit as a bass player when you're working with a drummer, how important it is to get that pocket,
right,
and that feel. I mean, you know, because I'm a drummer, and there's a lot of different variations of pockets when I play with different bass players.
Right.
But when I'm playing with really good bass players, there's like one really good variation of a pocket because it's in the pocket. So
in the pocket's always good.
Yeah,
yes.
To the left
or the right of it isn't as comfy.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, is that something just from listening, or do you develop it, or how do you think about that?
I think you do. It is a constant process to develop it. I think some people have more innate pocket abilities,
know.
And that I think that everybody has their own kind of groove, and it's kind of figuring out where you can match up with that person, you know, without, like with students. And I really hesitate, you know, the middle of the beat, the top of the beat, the back of the beat, you know, the top of the middle, whatever. You know, that's all good, and it is definitely something to think about, especially when you're listening. So, example, when you listen to Ray Brown, Ray likes to push the beat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people that know that, because he's such a strong personality, might play in a certain way. Maybe they'll play behind, you know, and then they find that place where all of a sudden it clicks and off they go.
Mm-hmm.
And Ed Thigpen was, like, really struggling with where I was placing the beat a little bit. Loved my playing. It swung. But it still wasn't quite where he was used to it. And then he showed me how to push it, and I was like, oh, my goodness, that far ahead? But then all of a sudden, magic.
Yeah.
I found that place where it was really worked with him. Wouldn't work with other drummers. It didn't. And then people would be very mad at me. You know, very mad. Not happy at all. Not a pleasant situation. But with him, man, when I would put it in that place that was so far ahead, it worked. Mm-hmm. It just was like, bing, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, and as a bass player, I mean, you probably have to adjust more than a drummer, I would imagine. So if you're playing with Ed way up there, and then if you start playing with somebody else, I mean, you're like, oh, okay, this is where we're going to be tonight. Is that how you're thinking when you're playing? Or are you just
much
like, you know what, this is where it's at?
Well, a little bit of both.
Yeah.
It depends. I mean, I think if someone is really strong in their feel, you know, then we can work together. If someone is not, then I will tend to be, you know, kind of anchoring.
Yeah.
And make the decision to, you know, this is where it's at.
Right.
And then they can be mad at me, and I don't care.
Well, why don't we hear a track off,
sure,
off of this release, since we're talking about Ed Thigpen. So this is Easily Flight.
Easy Flight.
Easy Flight. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at it upside down.
Oh,
sorry.
It's okay.
I'm a drummer. I know what the joke is going to be.
No. A bad joke. It's just not right.
So what track
Let's
do you think
see.
We should hear?
What should we do? Good question. Oh, wow. I don't know. I hear a Rhapsody. Or we could do Easy Flight.
It's your choice, Easy Flight.
Easy Flight.
Okay, well, listen to the title track. This is Easy Flight, the Ed Thigpen Ensemble. We're here with Marlene Rosenberg on Chicago Jazz Revealed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're back here at Chicago Jazz Revealed, live at Katerina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road. As the crowd goes wild, Marlene, see, do you see the crazy crowd that comes
in? I'm so appreciative. I love it. It is kind of a nutty crowd. Yeah. Oh, in the best sense of the word, really.
That's right. That's right. Well, we just heard a track off of the release that you had with Ed Thigpen, but why don't we talk a little bit about your new release, which came out last year, I believe.
Yes, it
did.
Was
it last year?
Yeah.
Bass Print, the Marlene Rosenberg Quartet, and it's got Jeff Bradfield and Scott Hesse,
who's
here? You're going to be performing with a little bit later, and Micaiah McRaven and yourself.
Right.
Now, are these all original tunes?
Well, most of them are. And two of them are by Kenny Barron, the great pianist in New York. I had the privilege of meeting him many years back, where I met a lot of people, especially having played with Joe Henderson and Joe Williams, you know, Nancy Wilson, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So enough already. So,
well, see, I'm trying to jump to this because you and I could be talking until 10:30 tonight.
Oh, so darn, that's right. I could. That's true. So anyway, he asked me 20 years ago, would I want to rehearse? And I don't know. It just never happened. And so last year I called and said, Kenny, I'm ready to rehearse. I know it's 20 years later, and I'm a little slow. And he just laughed, and so I was in town, and we played like 3 hours. Anyway, we played Sun Shower and Lullaby were his tunes.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, that'd be great to put on the CD.
Now, how did the CD come about? I mean, you know, you're probably so busy doing so many other things. I know how difficult it is to actually plan out doing a CD project and putting something together like this.
Yeah, I just sort of dig my heels in and say, you need to do a CD. And so I wrote some songs and so that I don't become extinct. I just, you know, surge for it. And then Origin was recommended to me, and I've been real happy with, you know, everything
that's come from them.
Yeah,
great label. Now, is this a group that you were working with before? Did you kind of put the group together? And now, because I know you guys have some shows coming up.
Right, I did, and we worked actually at Andy's for like 4 months prior to the recording. Imagine that. And so it was a beautiful, really nice, because it really it feels like a group.
Mm-hmm.
And even when we don't play, you know, it's kind of like, you know, reunion time.
Yeah.
You know,
that's gotta be, actually we should talk a little, I got a question about that too, is that I'm sure you've played on a lot of different bands where it's an all-star band or it's this band or it's that band where you're kind of put in the mix on a festival here or there. But what's it like actually playing with steady guys on a weekly basis and really getting the whole group together? As opposed to like being thrown into a, you know, here's an all-star band or here's this gig or here's that gig. I mean,
that's great because you can really stretch and do things that you wouldn't otherwise do in terms of changing feels. And any of my tunes may not be the same feel that we played last week. You know, Micaiah might think, oh, I'll do this. And,
You know,
or Scott will play, you know, whatever wild and crazy, beautiful voicings he plays on something, and you know, Jeff will play something, and we just kind of go with it, you know, and we don't really worry about it, you know. It's not about right and wrong; it's about exploration at that point.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about, I mean, it sounds like you're able to take more chances because you trust the rest of the guys in the band at that point because you're with them. There's so many things going on in the music business nowadays where, you know, let's go play this gig, let's go play that gig, and nobody's ever rehearsing, nobody's ever getting tight.
Right.
When you were coming up through U of I, what you talked about, too, is that you guys used to get together and jam and things like that. How important is it for, like, a group, like your group, to actually, like, play steady gigs, to play on a regular basis, to do that? Because you don't get that same feel, that same thing happening, do you, when you're not doing that?
No, but it's, you know, not always realistic, unfortunately, given many things,
right?
You know, but But yeah, at the highest level, it's the best, you know, and rehearsing is important, and we did rehearse, and we do rehearse, and, you know, yeah, to do the best we can.
Yeah.
Make the music sound as good as it can sound, you know. But, like, yeah, back in the day, you know, like VSOP, Miles' group, or groups that would work consistently, Dexter Gordon, you know, there's a ton. And there are some today, too. You know, they do sound like a group. There's mm-hmm. a sound, you know.
That's got to be the hardest thing, too, right, as a group, is to get a sound.
Well, you can't help but do it if you're playing all the time.
Yeah.
It's kind of just sort of goes there.
Right.
Now, then the harder part might be you reach a plateau and try to get away from that, you know, kind of like maybe a caricature of,
okay,
you know,
sure.
you know, you try and push the envelope of what you're comfortable with,
mm-hmm.
with that sound.
Yeah.
So.
And it either works or it doesn't work, right?
Well, eventually, I think if you have that in your mind, and the group does, that you can go to the next place, or if the leader makes something different about what you're supposed to do or what they'd like you to do, that would change it.
Yeah.
You know, and then people could work with that formula mm-hmm. a little bit, you know.
As a leader, especially on a CD, you know, that's yours and it's your group, I mean, do you suggest things? Do you, you know, hey, you
oh,
know,
yeah.
why don't we do this? Or, you know, let's not do that, let's do this. I mean, is that easy to do as a leader, or is that something that you have to kind of like, or just because you know the guys in the band, is like, no problem. Hey, you know what, just play this. Let's do this. You know, that's it.
I don't know, Scott. What do you say?
We'll have the after-set interview with
the
Scott.
The after-set, yeah. I'm the boss. See, he knows. No, but actually... And I'm buying him dinner tonight. That's right.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh. So, but truly, yes, I ask for what I want when I know what I want.
Mm-hmm.
The guys bring up certain ideas, and I'm certainly always open to that because I respect them. And it's a group effort.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah, you know, ultimately, there are certain things I like in the music, like to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we hear a track off of this release?
Sure.
And then we'll get you all set up. We'll have one more little segment, and then we'll have you go up and play live for
all
us,
right.
too.
All
right.
Thanks.
What tune do you
what
think we
tune?
Should hear?
Eeny, meeny. Oh, my. How about... I don't know. Tale of Two Monk Keys.
Tale of
That's
Two Monk Keys.
A favorite.
Tale
Thanks,
of Two
Paul.
Monk Keys.
Yay!
The audience says that
the
that's a good track.
Has given
Thank
their
goodness.
Opinion. Good choice.
Thank goodness. All right. Well, why don't we take a listen to that here with Marlene Rosenberg, and this is off of Bass Print. She's going to be performing. We're going to talk about this for briefly when she comes back. But I should mention before we get off completely off on a tangent, I forget. You're going to have this quartet, or, you know, your quartet, September 6th and 7th at Andy's, which is 11 East Hubbard Street in Chicago, from 5 to 8:30 p.m.
Correct.
And then you're also going to be playing, you also play Mondays with
right.
a different group, but on Mondays you're at Andy's. What time is that?
That's a 9 p.m.
9 p.m.
to
at 1 Andy's.
a.m.
Every Monday.
Every Monday. It's a three-trumpet summit.
Oh, with who?
Three-trumpet Marcus Carroll, Ryan Neither, and Sean Johnson on trumpet, Xavier Breaker on mm-hmm. drums, and Stu Mindeman on piano.
Oh, great.
And myself.
Okay. Well, if you like what you hear, we're going to take a listen to Tale of Two Monk Keys. You can check Marlene out at Andy's on September 6th and 7th from 5 to 8:30. And let's take a listen here on Chicago Jazz Revealed, 90.9 FM. WDCB. Thank you. Here at Katarina's, 1920 West Irving Park Road, with Chicago Jazz Revealed. I'm Mike Jeffers. I'm still here with Marlene Rosenberg. We're going to have her go up and perform a couple of tunes here. But before we do that, now where can they get more information on you and where you're playing?
Well, if I would, or my secretary would update my website, we'd all be much better off. Definitely on Facebook Or you can go to my website, MarleneRosenberg.com.
And I'm sure they can purchase the CD through there as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, please do.
There you go. So even if your gigs aren't updated, the CD is updated.
CD is.
It's ready to go.
It's ready to go, and it's on iTunes and Amazon and soon to be on CD Baby.
Perfect. Yeah. Now, we mentioned the September 6th and 7th, 5 to 8:30 at Andy's, and then, of course, the Trumpet Summit on Monday nights from 9 p.m. until 1 a.m.
Correct.
At Andy's, 11 East Hubbard Street. But you also have a couple of other gigs coming up, one of them being the Hyde Park Jazz Festival, September 28th.
Right, and that's 6:45.
That's on the...
It's on the main stage, actually.
On the Midway? Right on the Midway, right?
I believe so.
Yeah. With Denise...
Times. She's a fabulous vocalist from St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
And she's coming in, and we're going to do a set and jazz it out.
Jazz it out. And then you're going to be jazzing it out again October 3rd through the 6th with Bobby Watson. Yeah, at the Jazz Showcase.
One of my favorites. And a fabulous, underrated saxophone, alto saxophone player, composer. He's an educator at Kansas University, and really fabulous. You know, he's one of the Blakeyites,
right?
You know, jazz messengers from that time. So,
and then October 18th and 19th. I'm just shooting down it because I want to make sure we get everything in before we run out of time. The October 18th and 19th from 5 to 8:30. You're going to be at Andy's, 11 East Hubbard, with. Louis Nash is coming in town.
Yes. Originally, a vocalist, a very fine vocalist in New York, Marion Sullivan, and I had met through Christian McBride and Louis Nash. And Christian was on her CD that Jeremy Pelt helped produce. Anyway, we had been talking about doing something. She wanted to come to Chicago. So I thought, well, maybe Andy's would work.
Yeah.
And it did. And then I thought, why don't I just go for it and ask? Because I've been wanting to play with Louis. I've been trying to rehearse and get. And he is so busy and amazing.
Yeah.
And I've known him from back when I was touring with Joe Henderson.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we've stayed in touch. And I go and hear him play. And we talk. And we see each other when he's in town. So he said yes. And, of course, you know.
Oh, that's great.
I'm promoting it myself. You know, we know what that means. And and so
make sure you go to Andy's October 18th and 19th.
Please.
That's what it means.
Please. And then so Marion Sullivan, fabulous singer. Reggie Thomas, a mm-hmm. great piano player. He teaches out in Michigan. He's in some way affiliated with the Lincoln Center.
Okay.
Educational.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Deese, who's an amazing trombone player, is going to come in on that Saturday. And then, of course, Louis will be there both nights. So
yeah.
It's going to be a good festivities.
Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah.
So. Well, thanks for coming on.
Thank you,
and,
Mike. Thanks for having me.
Why don't I let you head towards the stage, and we're going to hear a couple of live tunes here at Katarina's from Marlene Rosenberg and Scott Hesse. And... of course, we tape here live every Tuesday night from 6 to 8, so you come on down and come on by. You never know what's going to happen here at Chicago Jazz Revealed. So why don't we take a little break, and we will be back with some live music.
All right. Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right. Okay. This selection is called LJ. By me, and it's on my recent CD called Bassprint. Thank you.